This CLE course covers the significant appellate division decisions that addressed civil procedure, which were released January 2025 through June 2025. I choose only the most informative decisions, mostly reversals, almost all opinions, and almost all memorandum decisions which have substantive dissents. I summarize them, post the summaries on the New York Appellate Digest website, and then every month I compile the summaries that address civil procedure into a reversal report. These six monthly reversal reports for January through June 2025 are the written materials for this CLE course. So starting with the first reversal report, January 2025, on pages 2 and 3 is the McWashington case. The case stems from a slip and fall in a hotel. In addition to suing the hotel, the plaintiff sued Agoda, which was the agency plaintiff used to book the stay at the hotel. Plaintiff's agreement with Agoda included an arbitration clause, and plaintiff sought to compel arbitration. The arbitration clause unequivocally limited Agoda's liability to its reservation and booking service, and specifically excluded liability for personal injury at the place where the reservation was made. The agreement stated, Agoda does not in any way own, manage, operate, or control the accommodations and will not be liable in damages for any personal injury or other damages attributable to the accommodation. Agoda moved to dismiss the complaint under CPLR 3211A1, which allows dismissal of an action based solely on documentary evidence. The statute reads, a party may move for judgment dismissing one or more causes of action asserted against him on the ground that a defense is founded upon documentary evidence. I included the case here in civil procedure as an example of the type of documentary evidence which will support dismissal at the outset of the litigation under CPLR 3211A1. There are hundreds of appellate reversals finding that the documents relied upon by the plaintiff did not meet the criteria for documentary evidence. Affidavits or letters or emails, for example, generally will not be sufficient for dismissal. Here, the terms of use in the arbitration clause met the criteria for a documentary evidence-based dismissal. The First Department reversed Supreme Court dismissed the complaint based on the unequivocal terms of use in the agreement between plaintiff and Agoda. It seems too bad that it took an appeal for a ruling which was warranted at the very outset of the case. Next is Garcia on pages 3 and 4 of the January 2025 Civil Procedure Reversal Report. Here, a statute which was enacted to correct an erroneous judicial interpretation of the workers' compensation law was applied retroactively to revive a dismissed personal injury action. Plaintiff was injured in a construction accident. He simultaneously brought this civil suit and applied for workers' compensation. The workers' compensation board held his injuries were not related to the accident. The defendant successfully moved for summary judgment, arguing that the Workers' Compensation Board ruling required dismissal of the civil suit under the doctrine of collateral estoppel. 2 years after this civil action was commenced, the New York legislature passed the Justice for Injured Workers Act, which precludes giving a Workers' Compensation Board's ruling collateral estoppel effect in a subsequent personal injury action. The question before the appellate court was whether the 2022 amendment, which precluded invoking the collateral estoppel doctrine in this context, should be applied to this action, which was started 2 years before in 2020. The court determined the amendment should be applied retroactively because it was intended to be remedial in nature. As the court explained it, the act's legislative sponsor explained that its purpose was to correct what the legislature perceived to be an injustice to injured workers caused by Second Department precedent and left unresolved by the Court of Appeals. The act was intended to return to what the legislature perceived to have been the rule for almost 80 years, namely that courts in third-party actions would reject attempts by defendants to apply collateral estoppel to decisions reached in the swift and cursory workers' compensation context, and that workers would not be prevented from exercising their constitutional right to a jury trial. So the takeaway here, statutes which are intended to correct an erroneous judicial interpretation of the law are considered remedial. Remedial statutes can be applied retroactively to actions commenced before enactment. Next is Guang, pages 6 and 7 of the January 2025 Civil Procedure Reversal Report. This wrongful death case examines the overlapping jurisdictions of Supreme Court and the Workers' Compensation Board. Defendants brought a summary judgment motion in Supreme Court, arguing that workers' compensation was plaintiff's exclusive remedy. Supreme Court denied the motion. The appellate court reversed, holding that only the Workers' Compensation Board can determine whether workers' compensation is the exclusive remedy here. As the court explained it, primary jurisdiction for determinations as to the applicability of the workers' compensation law has been vested in the Workers' Compensation Board. It is therefore inappropriate for the courts to express views with respect thereto in the absence of a determination by the board. Where the issue of the applicability of the workers' compensation law is in dispute, and a plaintiff fails to litigate that issue before the board, a court should not express an opinion as to the availability of compensation, but should refer the matter to the board because the board's disposition of the plaintiff's compensation claim is a jurisdictional predicate to the civil action. So the takeaway here, if the applicability of the workers' compensation law in a personal injury case is in dispute, only the workers' compensation board, not the court, can decide whether it has jurisdiction. The board's disposition is a jurisdictional predicate to any subsequent civil action in court. Next is Matter of Supinski on pages 8 and 9 of the January 2025 Civil Procedure Reversal Report. If a judge determines there are necessary parties that have not been included in the action, the proper remedy is not dismissal. The judge should direct that the necessary parties be summoned. The court's power to order that the necessary parties be summoned is not affected by the running of the statute of limitations. Only the party can raise the statute of limitations defense. As the court explained it, when a necessary party has not been made a party and is subject to the jurisdiction of the court, the proper remedy is not dismissal of the complaint or the petition, but rather for the court to direct that the necessary party be summoned, and it cites CPLR section 1001, subdivision B. Next is DeRusso on pages 8 and 9 of the January 2025 Civil Procedure Reversal Report. This case illustrates the importance of the wording of a statute which creates a private right of action. Based upon the statutory definitions, the court determined that Public Health Law Article 28 creates a private right of action against residential health care facilities, but not against assisted living facilities, which are governed by Public Health Law Article 46B. As the court explained, Public Health Law Section 2801D creates a private right of action distinct from traditional claims for medical malpractice and negligence, and it provides in relevant part that, quote, any residential health care facility that deprives any patient of said facility of any right or benefit shall be liable to the patient for injuries suffered as a result of said deprivation, close quote. A residential health care facility is defined, in turn, as, quote, a nursing home or facility providing health-related service, close quote. An assisted living facility, in contrast, is governed by Public Health Law Article 46B instead of Public Health Law Article 28, being defined as a facility that, quote, provides or arranges for housing, on-site monitoring, and personal care services and or home care services, either directly or indirectly, in a home-like setting to five or more adult residents unrelated to the assisted living provider. So the takeaway of this case is that the private right of action created by Public Health Law 2801D creates a private right of action against residential health care facilities, but the public health law does not create a private right of action against an assisted living facility. Next is the REO opportunity case on pages 11 and 12 of the January 2025 Civil Procedure Reversal Report. This case simply illustrates standing requirements unique to foreclosure actions. The plaintiff in a foreclosure must demonstrate that both the mortgage and the note were assigned to it prior to the commencement of the action. Here, plaintiff was able to demonstrate the mortgage was assigned to it, but not the note. The court noted that a transfer of the mortgage without the debt is a nullity. So in that case, the bank or the entity bringing the foreclosure action was unable to demonstrate that it had standing to bring the foreclosure action in court. Next is Matter of Sinclair on pages 12 and 13 of the January 2025 Civil Procedure Reversal Report. Here there was a question of whether the so-called insanity toll of the statute of limitations applied to render the assault and false arrest action against the city timely. The court explained the elements of the insanity toll in the context of an action against a municipality, which requires a timely filing of a notice of claim. The court wrote, pursuant to CPLR 208, subdivision A, if a person entitled to commence an action is under a disability because of insanity at the time the cause of action accrues, and the time otherwise limited for commencing the action is less than 3 years, the time shall be extended by the period of disability. A toll pursuant to CPLR 208 subdivision A does not toll the necessity of filing a timely notice of claim against the municipality. Rather, it tolls only the time in which to apply for leave to serve a late notice of claim. CPLR 208 subdivision A provides no definition of the term insanity. However, the Court of Appeals has concluded that the insanity tolling provision should be narrowly construed and is available only to those individuals who are unable to protect their legal rights because of an overall inability to function in society. The condition of an individual's mental capabilities is largely a factual question. The task of determining whether the tolling provision of CPLR 208 applies is a pragmatic one, which necessarily involves consideration of all surrounding facts and circumstances relevant to the claimant's ability to safeguard his or her legal rights. Here, the record before us presents a question of fact as to whether the petitioner was able to protect his legal rights because of an overall inability to function in society during the relevant period. The main takeaway from this case is although the statute of limitations can be told by the plaintiff's insanity, it doesn't toll the time for filing a notice of claim if the action is against a municipality. Next is Abaroles, A-B-A-R-R-O-L-E-S, on pages 13 and 14 of the January 2025 Civil Procedure Reversal Report. This case illustrates when the statute of limitations starts to run on a breach of contract action. The clock started running when the plaintiff had the right to demand payment on the lease, not when the demand was actually made. The statute of limitations cannot be extended by failing to make a demand. Here, the unpaid additional rent went back to 2006, but payment wasn't demanded until 2019. Plaintiff was only entitled to recover the unpaid rent which accrued during the 6 years prior to the 2019 demand for payment. As the court explained it, although the motion court awarded the entirety of the amounts of unpaid additional rent going back to 2006, the landlord's inexplicable delay in asserting these counterclaims until September 2019 rendered the amounts that accrued before September 2013 time-barred, and it cites CPLR 213 subdivision 2. The law is well settled that the statute of limitations on breach of contract claims begin to run when the party that was owed money had the right to demand payment, not when it actually made the demand. Because the limitations period cannot be extended by simply failing to make a demand, the judgment must be reduced to include only those amounts that accrued after September 2013. Next is Jackson on page 14. We're still in the January 2025 Civil Procedure Reversal Report. Here the court reiterated that a motion for summary judgment can be made any time after issue is joined. Therefore, the judge had no authority to deny a motion for summary judgment on the ground that a note of issue had not been filed. As the court explained it, CPLR 3212 subdivision A provides that any party may move for summary judgment once issue has been joined. The court may set a date after which no such motion may be made, which must be at least 30 days after the filing of the note of issue. That's CPLR 3212 subdivision A. The court has no authority to require the filing of a note of issue as a prerequisite to a motion for summary judgment, since CPLR 3212 subdivision A clearly states that a motion for summary judgment may be made once issue has been joined. Next is the last case in the January 2025 Civil Procedure Reversal Report. It's Anderson on page 15. Plaintiff sued the city for damage caused when plaintiff drove over an open manhole. The municipality moved for summary judgment on the ground it had not received written notice of the hazard. In response, plaintiff, for the first time, raised the special use exception to the written notice requirement. The court said it was too late. The exception should have been raised in the notice of claim or in the complaint. As the court explained it, a municipality that has enacted a prior written notification law may avoid liability for a defect or hazardous condition that falls within the scope of the law if it can establish that it has not been notified in writing of the existence of the defect or hazard at a specific location. Such prior written notice is obviated where the plaintiff demonstrates the municipality created the defect or hazard through an affirmative act of negligence or that a special use conferred a benefit on the municipality. Here the plaintiff did not dispute that defendants established that they had no prior written notice of the alleged roadway defect. In opposition, the plaintiff instead argued that the special use exception applied. The plaintiff, however, failed to allege that exception in either the notice of claim or the complaint. Therefore, that new theory of liability was improperly raised in opposition to the defendant's motion for summary judgment dismissing the complaint. So the takeaway, if you're suing a city for damage caused by a road hazard, find out if the city has a written notice requirement. If it does, it's prudent to allege any applicable exceptions to the written notice requirement at the very outset of the case, in the notice of claim, or in the complaint. Okay, that was the last case in the January 2025 civil procedure reversal report. We're now moving to the February 2025 civil procedure reversal report. The next case is Matter of Robinson on pages 3 and 4. Here, the order to show cause and petition were dismissed because the action was not brought in the proper form. The Second Department reversed because CPLR Section 103 Subdivision A gives a court the authority to convert a proceeding to the proper form. The order to show cause should have been deemed a summons, and the petition should have been deemed a complaint for medical malpractice. The case was remitted for service of an answer. Next is Doe versus Educational Institute on page 5 of the February 2025 reversal report. The issue here is the sufficiency of a negligent supervision complaint against a school under the Child Victims Act, alleging sexual abuse of a student by a teacher. To survive a motion to dismiss, the complaint must allege facts. Simply alleging the school knew or should have known of the teacher's propensity for abuse is not enough. As the court explained it, the complaint did not sufficiently plead that the school knew or should have known of the teacher's propensity to commit the alleged wrongful acts, and failed to provide any factual allegations from which it could be inferred that the school had prior notice of similar conduct at its dormitory. The complaint merely asserted bare legal conclusions that the school knew or should have known of the teacher's propensity for improper conduct without providing any factual allegations that the teacher's abuse of the plaintiff was foreseeable. So the takeaway here: a Child Victims Act negligent supervision complaint against the school based on sexual abuse of a student by a teacher must allege facts which demonstrate the teacher's actions were foreseeable by the school. Just alleging the school knew or should have known will result in dismissal of the complaint for failure to state a cause of action. Next is Weisbrod Moore on pages 6 and 7 of the February 2025 report. This is an important reversal by the Court of Appeals in the area of municipal law. Although the placement of a child in foster care is a governmental function, which usually triggers governmental immunity, the Court of Appeals held that children placed in foster care are owed a special duty by the municipality. The municipality can be sued for breach of that special duty. Here, plaintiff sued the county under the Child Victims Act for sexual abuse by a foster parent in the 70s and 80s. The Court of Appeals said, by assuming legal custody over the foster child, the applicable government official steps in as the sole legal authority responsible for determining who has daily control over the child's life. We hold that a municipality owes a duty to a foster child over whom it has assumed legal custody to guard the child from foreseeable risks of harm arising from the child's placement with the municipality's choice of foster parent. Next is Deutsche Bank on pages 8 and 9 of the February 2025 report. Here in this foreclosure action, the bank did not take steps to obtain a default judgment within 1 year, which ordinarily allows defendant to move to dismiss the action as abandoned under CPLR Section 3215, Subdivision C. But whereas here the defendant submitted a late answer, the defendants waived their right to an abandonment dismissal. As the court explained it, a defendant may waive the right to seek dismissal pursuant to CPLR 3215, Subdivision C, by serving an answer or taking any other steps which may be viewed as a formal or informal appearance. Next is Wells Fargo Bank on pages 9 and 10 of the February 2025 report. This case illustrates how little it takes to defeat a motion to dismiss a foreclosure action as abandoned pursuant to CPLR 3215, Subdivision C. The bank moved for an order of reference within 1 year of the default. Even though the motion was denied, it was enough to preclude a default judgment. The court said, the plaintiff initiated proceedings for the entry of a judgment by moving for an order of reference within 1 year of the defendant's default in the action. The fact that Supreme Court rejected the motion as defective is beside the point, as the mere presentment of it established the plaintiff's intent to proceed toward the entry of judgment and not to abandon the action. Next is Matter of Riera on pages 10 and 11 of the February 2025 report. Here the court noted that although family court can proceed in a custody matter when a party defaults, it must hold a hearing and make specific findings about the best interest of the child. The failure to hold a hearing and create a record where a party defaults requires reversal. Next is Matter of Anderson on pages 11 and 12 of the February 2025 report. Here, the Third Department held that under the Family Court Act and the CPLR, service upon a party in a pending case means service upon the party's counsel, not the party. The issue was whether mother's objections to a child support order were served on the opposing party. The objections were not properly served because they were not served on the opposing party's counsel. The court explained, Family Court Act directs that a party filing objections shall serve a copy of such objections upon the opposing party, who shall have 13 days from such service to serve and file a written rebuttal to such objections. This provision does not address the issue of whether service on an attorney representing a party constitutes service on the opposing party. Where a method of procedure is not prescribed, Family Court Act Section 165, Subdivision A, provides that the provisions of the CPLR shall apply to the extent that they are appropriate to the proceedings involved. CPLR 2103 specifically pertains to the service of papers and provides that papers to be served upon a party in a pending action shall be served upon the party's attorney. That's CPLR 2103, Subdivision B. Accordingly, service upon an opposing party represented by counsel requires service on the attorney, not the party. Next is Wharton Bickley on pages 15 and 16 of the February 2025 report. Here, the First Department clarified the purposes of and criteria for a so-called Yellowstone preliminary injunction, which is available when a disputed commercial lease agreement is ambiguous. The injunction tolls the cure period until a court rules on whether the landlord's or the tenant's interpretation of the agreement is correct. As the court explained it, the Yellowstone injunction tolls the relevant cure period, thereby preventing the termination of the lease. With the Yellowstone injunction in place, the tenant can litigate with some confidence. If the tenant prevails in the underlying dispute with the landlord, the tenant walks away from the litigation with the lease intact. If the tenant loses the underlying dispute, the tenant can cure the demonstrated lease defaults before the expiration of the remaining cure period. Yellowstone relief is a unique injunction. Unlike a standard preliminary injunction that can be granted only upon a demanding three-part showing of a likelihood of success on the merits, irreparable injury, and that the equities favor the party seeking the preliminary injunction, a Yellowstone injunction is granted on far less a showing. The party seeking Yellowstone relief must demonstrate the following four elements. 1. It holds a commercial lease. 2. It received from the landlord either a notice of default, a notice to cure, or a threat of termination of the lease. 3. It requested injunctive relief prior to the termination of the lease. And 4. It is prepared and maintains the ability to cure the alleged default by any means short of vacating the premises. The next case is Drayton, on pages 16 and 17 of the February 2025 report. Here, the Second Department held plaintiff's motion for a mistrial in a personal injury action should have been granted. Defense counsel was allowed to cross-examine plaintiff about his status as a defendant in a pending lawsuit, apparently to call plaintiff's credibility into question. As the court explained it, the court improvidently permitted defense counsel to cross-examine the plaintiff as to whether he was the defendant in a pending lawsuit alleging nonpayment, since the lawsuit had not resulted in an adverse finding against the plaintiff, and the fact that the lawsuit had been commenced in and of itself had little or no probative value with regard to the plaintiff's credibility. So the takeaway here is attempting to call into question a witness's credibility by bringing up the fact that the witness is a defendant in a pending lawsuit, which has not been resolved, can result in a mistrial. Next is Adams on page 17 of the February 2025 report. Here, the plaintiff failed to file a note of issue by the court-ordered deadline. No 90-day notice had been served on the plaintiff, nor had the court ordered dismissal of the action. In that situation, restoration of the matter to the active calendar is automatic upon plaintiff's motion. Plaintiff need not offer an excuse for missing the deadline. As the court explained, when a plaintiff has failed to file a note of issue by a court-ordered deadline, restoration of the action to the active calendar is automatic unless either a 90-day notice has been served pursuant to CPLR 3216, or there has been an order directing dismissal of the complaint pursuant to 22 NYCRR, section 202.27. In the absence of those two circumstances, the court need not consider whether the plaintiff had a reasonable excuse for failing to timely file a note of issue. Next is Fernandez, page 18 of the February 2025 report. Here, the Second Department determined the causes of action for conversion and unjust enrichment stemmed from alleged breaches of a partnership agreement. Therefore, the 6-year breach of contract statute of limitations, not the 3-year tort statute of limitations, applied. The court wrote, in determining which limitations period is applicable to a given cause of action, the court must look to the substance of the allegations rather than to the characterization of those allegations by the parties. When damage to property or pecuniary interests is involved, the 6-year statute governs regardless of how the theory of liability is described, as long as the asserted liability had its genesis in the contractual relationship of the parties. Thus, where liability is premised on a contractual relationship, the 6-year statute of limitations applies. Next is Berechka on pages 20 and 21 of the February 2025 report. What is the correct statute of limitations period for a breach of fiduciary duty? It depends on what relief is requested. For equitable relief, the statute is 6 years. For money damages, the statute is 3 years. Where fraud is alleged, the statute is 6 years. The statute does not begin to run until the fiduciary openly repudiates or terminates the relationship. As the court explained it, New York law does not provide a single statute of limitations for breach of fiduciary duty claims. Rather, the statute of limitations for a cause of action sounding in breach of fiduciary duty is dependent on the relief sought. Generally, a cause of action alleging breach of fiduciary duty is governed by a 6-year statute of limitations where the relief sought is equitable in nature, and it cites CPLR Section 213, Subdivision 1, or by a 3-year statute of limitations where the only relief sought is money damages, and it cites CPLR Section 214, Subdivision 4. Moreover, where an allegation of fraud is essential to a breach of fiduciary duty claim, courts have applied a 6-year statute of limitations under CPLR 213, Subdivision 8. The statute of limitations for a cause of action alleging a breach of fiduciary duty does not begin to run until the fiduciary has openly repudiated his or her obligation or the relationship has otherwise been terminated. Next is Nichols on pages 21 and 22 of the February 2025 report. Here the bank brought a foreclosure action in 2011, but it was dismissed because the bank did not comply with the notice of default provision in the mortgage. Therefore, the mortgage was never accelerated and the statute of limitations on the foreclosure action never started running. The court wrote, the bank established that the acceleration of the debt was a nullity due to the Supreme Court's determination that the mortgage company failed to establish proper mailing of the notice of default, a contractual condition precedent to acceleration of the debt. Accordingly, the statute of limitations to foreclose the mortgage never accrued. Next is Otero on pages 22 and 23 of the February 2025 report. Here, the Fourth Department held that an issue first raised in reply papers should not have been considered by Supreme Court. The Fourth Department wrote, Supreme Court improperly granted the motion based on an argument advanced for the first time in reply. The function of reply papers is to address arguments made in opposition to the position taken by the moving party and not to permit the moving party to induce new arguments in support of or new grounds or evidence for the motion. That was the last case in the February 2025 reversal report and civil procedure. And we're moving now to the March 2025 Civil Procedure Reversal Report. The next case is Great Neck on pages 3 and 4 of the March 2025 report. Second Department explained the criteria for amending a complaint after the statute of limitations has run, as well as the criteria for joining two actions. The original complaint alleged defendant architects committed professional malpractice for the defective design, supervision, and inspection of the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system. The proposed amended complaint alleged defendant provided architectural plans and specifications with respect to the plaintiff's front entrance, roof, exterior railings, bathrooms, lighting control devices, and sprinklers, and failed to properly design, inspect, and supervise those aspects of the project. The joinder motion sought to combine the first action, a suit by the general contractor against plaintiff for failure to pay, with the plaintiff's suit against the architects for defective design, supervision, and inspection. The motion to amend the complaint after the statute of limitations had run should have been granted because, one, the original complaint, in the words of CPLR Section 203, Subdivision F, gave notice of the transactions or occurrences on which the claims in the proposed amended complaint are based, and two, the defendants did not demonstrate they were prejudiced by the delay because discovery was ongoing at the time the motion to amend the complaint was brought. So the takeaway here, the motion to join the two actions should have been granted because the defendants didn't demonstrate they would be prejudiced by the joinder, and the two actions arose from the same project, concerned the same parties, and involved common questions of law and fact. Next is Wright on pages 4 and 5 of the March 2025 report. This is a Child Victims Act case alleging the claimant, Wright, was abused by state employees in a state-owned performing arts center, as well as by members of the public between 1986 and 1990. The Court of Appeals held that the claim lacked the specificity required to allow the state to investigate the allegations and dismissed it. As the Court of Appeals explained, the claim lacks critical information about the abusers. It alleges that the perpetrators included teachers, coaches, counselors, and perhaps other employees of the state, but it does not explain whether those employees were Wright's teachers, Wright's coaches, and Wright's counselors, or why, as a child, he was in their company multiple times between 1986 and 1990. The claim also alleges that members of the public are responsible for some of the abuse he suffered, but it does not explain why Wright came into contact with those persons as a child, the context in which adult supervision of any particular activity allegedly should have been provided, or the extent to which the state bore responsibility for Wright's contact with the abusers. Nor does the claim adequately allege what repeatedly brought Wright to the State Performing Arts Center over a four-year period in the late 1980s, or why, once on the premises, he frequently engaged with both members of the public and state employees. In the absence of such information, the state cannot promptly investigate the claim and determine its liability under Wright's theories of negligence. The state is left to guess whether at any point during the four-year period alleged in the claim, it owed some duty to Wright, and if so, whether it breached that obligation. But it's not the state's burden to assemble information not included in a claim so that it may promptly investigate and assess its liability. Section 11B of the Court of Claims Act places that burden on the claimant. So the takeaway: a Child Victims Act complaint must include enough specific facts about who the alleged abusers were and why the alleged victim was in their presence to allow an investigation to be conducted. Where the state is being sued, it is the claimant's responsibility to assemble the information the state needs to investigate and to include that information in the claim. It would be prudent to assume the same specificity would be required for a Child Victims Act complaint against a school district or a county, for example. Next is Salati on pages 6 and 7 of the March 2025 Civil Procedure Reversal Report. This case illustrates that a contractual statute of limitations, which is reasonable and is in a written agreement, will be enforced by the courts. Here, the employment contract included a 6-month statute of limitations, Plaintiff commenced an employment discrimination action one day late, 6 months and one day after she was terminated, and the appellate division reversed Supreme Court and dismissed the complaint, enforcing the contractual 6-month statute of limitations. At this point, I'm going to insert the first verification code for the CLE, which covers civil procedure decisions issued from January 2025 through June 2025. The first verification code is statute of limitations. Again, the first verification code is statute of limitations. The next case is Martin on pages 9 and 10 of the March 2025 report. CPLR Section 4504, Subdivision A, provides that a person authorized to practice medicine cannot disclose any information acquired in attending a patient. Here, the Fourth Department held that a non-party's medical records were material and necessary to the plaintiff's claim. The physician-patient privilege was overcome, and plaintiff could discover the non-party's records. Plaintiff alleged the hospital was negligent in placing plaintiff in a hospital room with a person, the non-party, with COVID. The non-party's medical records were deemed relevant to determining whether the hospital became aware of the non-party's COVID diagnosis. The court wrote, the physician-patient privilege may be overcome where the plaintiff establishes that the information in the medical records is material and necessary to their claim. Here, plaintiffs established that the non-party patient's hospital records would show when defendant, its agents, servants, and employees became aware that the patient had tested positive for COVID-19, and that such information is material and necessary to establish whether defendant had notice that it was placing plaintiff in the same room as a person who had COVID-19. So the takeaway here, where a non-party's medical records are material and necessary to a plaintiff's claim, the physician-patient privilege can be overcome and discovery of the non-party records can be allowed. Next is Flagstar Bank on page 15 of the March 2025 report. Where a defendant has appeared in the matter, and it has been more than a year since the defendant failed to answer the complaint, the defendant is entitled to notice of the application for a default judgment. The failure to provide the 5-day notice is a jurisdictional defect, which will render any default judgment a nullity. Next is matter of Dur Donas on pages 16 and 17 of the March 2025 report. Here, the Court of Appeals explained the proper procedure for claims brought by an employee pursuant to a collective bargaining agreement after exhaustion of the contractual grievance procedures. The proper procedure depends upon the nature of the claim. A claim based on a statutory or constitutional violation must be brought as an Article 78. A claim alleging the employer breached a provision of the collective bargaining agreement must be brought by a plenary civil action for breach of contract. As the court explained it, the procedure applicable to an employee's claim depends on the source of the right or benefit the employee asserts. Statutory or constitutional claims are appropriately brought in an Article 78 proceeding. Claims arising exclusively from an alleged breach of a term in a collective bargaining agreement must be brought through a civil action for breach of contract and must meet the requirements set out in a Court of Appeals case called Ambach, A-M-B-A-C-H. The citation for that is 70 New York Second at page 508. Next is Goldberg on pages 17 and 18 of the February 2025 report. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, deemed the allegations in the complaint sufficient to support piercing the corporate veil. The complaint must allege facts which preclude resolution by a motion to dismiss. The complaint alleged the defendant didn't adhere to the formalities required for a limited liability company, inadequately capitalized the corporate entities, commingled assets, and personally used the limited liability company's funds. The court concisely explained the criteria for piercing the corporate veil in the context of a motion to dismiss this way. To survive a motion to dismiss the complaint, a party seeking to pierce the corporate veil must allege facts that, if proved, establish that the party against whom the doctrine is asserted, 1, exercised complete domination over the corporation with respect to the transaction at issue, and 2, through such domination, abused the privilege of doing business in the corporate form to perpetrate a wrong or injustice against the plaintiff such that a court in equity will intervene. Factors to be considered in determining whether an individual has abused the privilege of doing business in the corporate or LLC form include the failure to adhere to LLC formalities, inadequate capitalization, commingling of assets, and the personal use of LLC funds. Additionally, the corporate veil will be pierced to achieve equity, even absent fraud, when a corporation has been so dominated by an individual or another corporation and its separate entity so ignored that it primarily transacts the dominator's business instead of its own and can be called the other's alter ego. A fact-laden claim to pierce the corporate veil is unsuited for resolution on a pre-answer, pre-discovery motion to dismiss. Next is Matter of Rossbau on pages 18 and 19 of the March 2025 Civil Procedure Reversal Report. It's a Court of Appeals case. Here, the Court of Appeals characterized the treble damages provision for the cutting of trees without the consent of the owner in the Real Property Actions and Proceedings Law as punitive. The action was brought by a property owner whose trees, which were along a roadway, were removed and trimmed by the town without consent. Punitive damages cannot be assessed against a municipality. The court explained why the treble damages provision was punitive as opposed to compensatory. The court wrote, "Treble damages are the default measure for any recovery, but the statute also provides that if the defendant establishes by clear and convincing evidence that when the defendant committed the violation, he or she had cause to believe the land was his or her own, or that he or she had an easement or right-of-way across such land which permitted such action, or he or she had a legal right to harvest such land, then he or she shall be liable for the stumpage value or $250 per tree or both." The good faith provision in Real Property Actions and Proceedings Law, Section 861, demonstrates the punitive nature of the treble damages available under the statute. And again, punitive damages cannot be assessed against a municipality, and here the action was against a town for cutting the trees along a roadway. Next is Guzman Martinez on pages 21 and 22 of the March 2025 report. Here the Fourth Department clarified the meaning of open court in the context of a stipulation of settlement. A stipulation of settlement, which is made in court and transcribed, is enforceable. Here, the stipulation of settlement was reached during a pretrial conference with the court's law clerk and could not, therefore, be enforced, as the court explained it. The record provides no basis for concluding that an enforceable stipulation was entered into between the parties, inasmuch as pertinent discussions took place off the record. Plaintiff failed to establish that the terms of the settlement agreement were filed with the county clerk, and it cites CPLR section 2104. The stipulation was not entered in open court, inasmuch as the alleged settlement was reached during a pretrial conference with the court's law clerk. The open court requirement is not satisfied in locations without a justice presiding and is not satisfied during less formal stages of litigation, such as a pretrial conference. Next is Matter of R.C., pages 22 and 23 of the March 2025 report. Here, the neglect petition against mother had been dismissed. At that point, family court lost subject matter jurisdiction. The court, therefore, did not have the authority to continue the child's placement in foster care. The court should have returned the child to mother as soon as the neglect petition was dismissed. Next is Majorana, on pages 23 and 24 of the March 2025 report. The issue here is whether the tort action stemming from a car accident must be brought in the court of claims because the defendant is a state parole officer who was driving a state-owned vehicle and was acting within the scope of her employment at the time of the accident. The Fourth Department held the action was properly brought in Supreme Court because the duty owed by the defendant was that owed directly to a fellow driver and was not a duty owed as a representative of the state. As the court explained it, if the suit against the state agent or officer is in tort for damages arising from the breach of a duty owed individually by such agent or officer directly to the injured party, the state is not the real party in interest, even though it could be held secondarily liable for the tortious acts under respondeat superior. Correction Law Section 24 places actions for money damages against state employees within the jurisdiction of the Court of Claims only where the conduct alleged is within the scope of the officer's employment and in the discharge of his or her official duties. Here, the complaint asserts defendant operated the vehicle in a negligent manner, i.e., that defendant's alleged negligence arises from her violation of a duty she owed plaintiff as a fellow driver and not as a state employee. Thus, plaintiff's action is against defendant individually for an alleged breach of a duty of care owed by the defendant directly to plaintiff and not one against state officers as representatives of the state in their official capacity. Next is the last case in the March 2025 Civil Procedure Reversal Report. It's HSBC Bank on pages 25 and 26. The defendant's attorney in this foreclosure action was suspended. Any action pending when a party's attorney is suspended is automatically stayed, and there are only two statutory procedures for lifting the stay. Because neither procedure for lifting the stay was implemented here, the judgment in this foreclosure action should have been vacated. As the court explained it, when an attorney is suspended from the practice of law, as with an attorney's death, incapacitation, removal from an action, or other disability, CPLR Section 321 Subdivision C protects the client by automatically staying the action from the date of the disabling event. There are two ways in which a stay may be lifted. One way is if the party that lost its counsel retains new counsel at its own initiative or otherwise communicates an intention to proceed pro se. The second way is by means of a notice procedure pursuant to CPLR Section 321, Subdivision C. It's undisputed that no attempt was made to personally serve the required notice, and it is undisputed that the defendant did not communicate an intention to proceed pro se. We are now moving to the April 2025 Civil Procedure Reversal Report. The next case is Thandy on pages 7 and 8. Here, the winner of the appeal was awarded costs by the appellate court, which included the expense of procuring the transcripts for the record on appeal. As the court explained it, pursuant to CPLR Section 8301, Subdivision A13, a party to whom costs are awarded on appeal is entitled to tax his or her necessary disbursements for reasonable and necessary expenses as are taxable according to the course and practice of the court, by express provision of law or by order of the court. Under the circumstances of this case, the defendant was entitled to disbursements for the expense of procuring trial transcripts for the purpose of preparing a record on appeal, pursuant to CPLR Section 8301, Subdivision A13. Next is Wolosuk, W-O-L-O-S-Z-U-K, on pages 9 and 10 of the April 2025 report. To be valid, a 90-day demand to resume prosecution must state that failure to comply will result in dismissal of the complaint. Here, no 90-day notice was served, and dismissal of the action was precluded on that ground alone. The argument that a scheduling order acted as a substitute for the 90-day demand was rejected because the scheduling order did not state that a dismissal of the complaint is a consequence of failure to comply with the order. As the Fourth Department explained, absent strict compliance with the conditions precedent to dismissal set forth in CPLR Section 3216, Subdivision B3, no dismissal shall be directed. The conditions precedent to bringing a motion to dismiss for failure to prosecute under CPLR 3216 must be complied with strictly. Among those conditions precedent are the service of a 90-day demand to resume prosecution by registered or certified mail, which specifically states that the failure to file the note of issue within 90 days will serve as a basis for a motion to dismiss for want of prosecution. Where the 90-day demand is served by the court, the demand shall also set forth the specific conduct constituting the neglect, which conduct shall demonstrate a general pattern of delay in proceeding with the litigation. Here, the court did not serve a 90-day demand upon plaintiff, and for that reason alone, the court erred in directing dismissal pursuant to CPLR Section 3216. Even assuming that the scheduling order could serve as a substitute for a 90-day demand, that scheduling order did not indicate that dismissal would result if plaintiff failed to file the note of issue, nor did it set forth the specific conduct constituting plaintiff's neglect. While an order may have the same effect as a valid 90-day demand, that order must advise the consequences for failure to comply, i.e., dismissal of the complaint, and here the order wholly failed to do so. So the takeaway, consult CPLR 3216 for the statutory conditions precedent for dismissal of a complaint. If a 90-day demand does not strictly comply with those statutory requirements, dismissal of the complaint will be reversed. Next is AWI Industries on page 10 of the April 2025 report. Here the court determined defendant's motion to dismiss should have been granted. Supreme Court had denied the motion because defendant's attorney affidavit relied on attached documents for which no foundation had been laid. But plaintiff didn't object to the documents and relied on them in opposing defendant's motion. As the First Department explained, an attorney's affirmation may properly serve as the vehicle for the submission of acceptable attachments which provide evidentiary proof in admissible form, like documentary evidence, so long as the affirmation constitutes a proper foundation for the admission of the records. The court was correct that defendant's attorney in her affirmation did not lay a foundation for the admission of the records, such as her personal knowledge or her certification of the documents as true and complete copies of the originals. However, plaintiff never objected to the admissibility of any of the documents annexed to the attorney's affirmation and relied on the same documents in opposition to defendant's motion. So the takeaway: an attorney affidavit is a proper vehicle for submitting documentary evidence, but the affidavit must lay a foundation for their admissibility. Even if no foundation has been laid, the documents may be rendered admissible if the opposing party doesn't object to them and relies on them in its own right. Next is Raphael, page 11 of the April 2025 report. This case gives some insight into what constitutes law office failure as an excuse for failing to submit a timely answer. Claiming an office backlog, miscalendaring, and misplacing papers was deemed insufficient. The court wrote, "The moving party must provide a detailed and credible explanation for the purported law office failure. A conclusory, undetailed, and uncorroborated claim of law office failure does not amount to a reasonable excuse." Here, the defendant's counsel asserted in a conclusory and undetailed manner that the initial deadline to serve an answer and the extension consented to by the plaintiff's former counsel were missed due to an office backlog and miscalendaring, and that the plaintiff's motion for leave to enter a default judgment was misplaced in the office. That was deemed insufficient to demonstrate a valid law office failure argument. Next is United Wholesale Mortgage on pages 12 and 13 of the April 2025 report. If the defendant in a foreclosure action raises the bank's lack of standing as an issue, the bank must prove it possessed the note at the time the action was commenced. Here, the bank was unable to do so, and summary judgment was reversed. As the court explained, here, where the note was endorsed in blank, meaning it was payable to any bearer of the instrument, plaintiff is required to perform the additional step of proving possession at the time of commencement of the action. So the takeaway here, if the defendant in a foreclosure action raises plaintiff's lack of standing as an issue, the plaintiff must prove it possessed the note at the commencement of the action in order to proceed. Next is Lara versus SNL Operational on pages 13 and 14 of the April 2025 report. The Emergency or Disaster Protection Act provided immunity to healthcare providers during COVID. The act was repealed in April 2021. In this case, the plaintiff attempted to sue a residential healthcare facility for plaintiff's decedent's COVID-related death, which occurred 2 months before the act providing immunity was repealed. Plaintiff made the interesting argument that the repeal of the act providing immunity to healthcare providers should be applied retroactively, thereby allowing the suit to go forward. But the Second Department rejected that argument without discussion. Here, the court held that a statute which repeals another statute will not be applied retroactively. Next is Grandelli versus City of New York on pages 16 and 17 of the April 2025 report. Here the complaint alleged that defendant Home Depot negligently entrusted a rental truck to a person who drove the truck into a crowd of pedestrians and bicyclists. Home Depot moved to dismiss the complaint on the ground it failed to state a cause of action for negligent entrustment. The defendant's motion to dismiss was accompanied by affidavits and documents which refuted allegations in the complaint. The judge erroneously treated the motion to dismiss as a motion for summary judgment and denied it. The First Department reversed, explaining that the submission of evidence in support of a motion to dismiss does not convert the motion to a motion of summary judgment, and the First Department held the motion to dismiss should have been granted. The court wrote, "Factual allegations presumed to be true on a motion pursuant to CPLR 3211 may properly be negated by affidavits and documentary evidence." So the takeaway, evidence submitted in support of a motion to dismiss a complaint for failure to state a cause of action doesn't convert the motion to dismiss to a motion for summary judgment. At this point, I'm going to insert the second verification code for this January 2025 through June 2025 civil procedure update. The second verification code is dismiss. Again, the second verification code for this January to June 2025 civil procedure update is dismiss. Next is Matter of Huvier, page 19 of the April 2025 report. Here, a writ of prohibition was properly granted to prevent a Supreme Court justice from ordering the release of grand jury minutes. Only the court charged with impaneling a grand jury can order release of the minutes. In Orange County, county court impanels grand juries. Therefore, the Orange County Supreme Court justice, by ordering release of the minutes, exceeded the powers of Supreme Court. Next is Matter of Weiss on page 20 of the April 2025 report. Here the defendants appeared in the proceeding and moved to dismiss the complaint without raising the defense of lack of personal jurisdiction. The judge sua sponte raised the issue of the propriety of service of process and dismissed the case. That was error. Defective service is an affirmative defense which, if not raised by a party, is waived. A judge cannot raise and decide the issue sua sponte. The court wrote, "The Supreme Court should not have sua sponte dismissed the proceeding on the ground of a defect in service. Lack of personal jurisdiction is an affirmative defense that can be waived by, among other things, appearing in an action, either formally or informally, without raising the defense of lack of personal jurisdiction in an answer or a pre-answer motion to dismiss. When a defendant participates in a lawsuit on the merits, he or she indicates an intention to submit to the court's jurisdiction over the action, and by appearing informally in this manner, the defendant confers in personam jurisdiction on the court." So the takeaway here, if a party does not raise lack of personal jurisdiction as an affirmative defense, the party waives the defense by participating in the suit. Once the defense is waived by a party, it cannot be raised by the judge. Next is Glenida Medical Care on pages 22 and 23 of the April 2025 report. Here the judge set aside the verdict based on post-discharge affidavits from two jurors who claimed the jurors were confused about the apportionment of liability. This was error. Although juror confusion can be a valid ground for setting aside a verdict, there must be some evidence of juror confusion in the record. There was none here. As the court explained, jurors may impeach their own verdict where the record demonstrates substantial confusion among the jurors in reaching a verdict. However, the use of post-discharge juror affidavits to attack the verdict is patently improper where the record is devoid of any evidence of juror confusion. Next is Brennan, pages 25 and 26 of the April 2025 report. This case illustrates the application of the Foreclosure Abuse Prevention Act, which was enacted to prevent the banks from being able to stop the six-year statute of limitations by unilaterally de-accelerating the debt. Under the Foreclosure Abuse Prevention Act, only a judicial determination that the filing of the foreclosure complaint did not accelerate the debt will prevent the dismissal of the action 6 years after filing. Here, the bank unsuccessfully argued that the 2018 dismissal of the 2013 foreclosure action based on the bank's failure to comply with the notice of default requirements constituted a judicial determination that the complaint did not accelerate the debt. As the court explained it, Supreme Court directed dismissal of the complaint in the 2013 action upon a determination that the bank failed to establish its strict compliance with Real Property Actions and Proceedings Law, Section 1304. The mailing of a Real Property Actions and Proceedings Law, Section 1304 notice, while a condition precedent to commencing a foreclosure action, is not a precondition for acceleration of the debt. Thus, the 2013 action was not dismissed upon an expressed judicial determination that the debt was not validly accelerated. So the takeaway, the filing of a foreclosure complaint starts the six-year statute of limitations. The subsequent dismissal of the foreclosure complaint will not stop the statute of limitations unless the court explicitly determines the complaint did not validly accelerate the debt. We move now to the May 2025 Civil Procedure Reversal Report. The next case is Rauch on pages 5 and 6 of the May 2025 report. Here, the defendant moved to dismiss the complaint on the ground it failed to state a cause of action. In response, plaintiff submitted an affidavit addressing the purported defects in the complaint. The motion court refused to consider the affidavit and granted the motion to dismiss. Failing to consider the affidavit was reversible error. As the Second Department explained it, on a motion to dismiss for failure to state a cause of action pursuant to CPLR 3211, Subdivision A7, a court must accept the facts as alleged in the complaint as true, accord plaintiffs the benefit of every possible favorable inference, and determine only whether the facts as alleged fit within any cognizable legal theory. Whether the complaint will later survive a motion for summary judgment, or whether the plaintiff will ultimately be able to prove his claims, plays no part in the determination of a pre-discovery CPLR Section 3211 motion to dismiss. Supreme Court should have considered plaintiff's affidavit to remedy any defects in the complaint when it assessed defendant's motion. So the takeaway, a plaintiff may submit an affidavit or other evidence to remedy defects in a complaint when faced with a motion to dismiss for failure to state a cause of action. The court must consider that evidence in assessing the validity of the complaint. Next is the Redd case, R-E-D-D, pages 8 and 9 of the May 2025 report. This is a Child Victims Act case against a school alleging the sexual abuse of plaintiff by a janitor. in dismissing the intentional infliction of emotional distress cause of action and the demand for punitive damages, the Second Department explained the criteria for both. The elements of intentional infliction of emotional distress are 1, extreme and outrageous conduct, 2, the intent to cause or the disregard of a substantial likelihood of causing severe emotional distress, 3, causation, and 4, severe emotional distress. The subject conduct must be so outrageous in character and so extreme in degree as to go beyond all possible bounds of decency and to be regarded as atrocious and utterly intolerable in a civilized community. Punitive damages are available for the purpose of vindicating a public right only where the actions of the alleged tortfeasor constitute gross recklessness or intentional, wanton, or malicious conduct aimed at the public generally or are activated by evil or reprehensible motives. So the takeaway here, only allegations of extremely outrageous behavior will support a cause of action for intentional infliction of emotional distress or a demand for punitive damages. Here, the allegations of sexual abuse of a child did not meet the criteria for intentional infliction of emotional distress or for punitive damages. Next is U.S. Bank on pages 12 and 13 of the May 2025 reversal report. This case illustrates the retroactive application of the Foreclosure Abuse Prevention Act. Again, as we saw in a prior case, the Act prohibits a bank from unilaterally deaccelerating a mortgage debt, which was accelerated by the filing of the foreclosure complaint, in order to stop the running of the 6-year statute of limitations. Under the Act, only an express judicial determination that the initial complaint did not accelerate the debt will stop the statute from running. Here, the Second Department held that the Act applies to foreclosure actions commenced before the effective date of the Act in December 2022. Because there was no judicial determination that the complaint did not accelerate the mortgage debt, the foreclosure action here was time-barred. Next is NationStar Mortgage on pages 13 and 14 of the May 2025 reversal report. This foreclosure case illustrates an evidentiary issue which recurs continuously and has recurred now for over a decade. Affidavits submitted by the bank in foreclosure actions are often worthless hearsay because the personal knowledge of the facts asserted by the affiant is not proven, either by an explicit claim of personal knowledge in the affidavit or by attached admissible business records. Here, the affidavit submitted by the bank to prove it had possession of the note at the time the action was commenced to demonstrate standing to foreclose was deemed inadmissible hearsay. As the court explained, the plaintiff relied on Harris's affidavit to demonstrate that it had possession of the note prior to commencing this action. Harris averred that the plaintiff received physical delivery of the original note on September 5, 2013. Harris failed to attach any business record to her affidavit to demonstrate that fact, or to aver that she had personal knowledge of the physical delivery of the note. Harris's averment that the plaintiff had possession of the note prior to the commencement of this action was inadmissible hearsay and insufficient to establish the plaintiff's standing. So the takeaway, unless an affiant demonstrates personal knowledge of a fact alleged in the affidavit or attaches admissible business records proving the alleged fact, the affidavit will be deemed inadmissible hearsay. This is a recurring appellate issue in foreclosure cases where the bank relies on affidavits from bank or mortgage company employees to support a motion for summary judgment. Next is Bohn, B-O-H-N, on pages 14 and 15 of the May 2025 report. This case illustrates the concept of judicial estoppel. If a debtor conceals an asset during a bankruptcy proceeding and then brings a suit to collect on that asset, the action is precluded by judicial estoppel. Here, the First Department held that the doctrine did not apply to attorney's fees deemed uncollectible in the bankruptcy proceeding. As the court explained it, Supreme Court incorrectly dismissed the complaint on the ground that judicial estoppel bars plaintiff from seeking attorney's fees that were deemed uncollectible in a bankruptcy proceeding. Judicial estoppel applies where it is shown that a debtor omitted or concealed the existence of an asset and later brought suit to collect on that asset. Here the court made no such findings, and in fact assumed that plaintiff had not misled the bankruptcy trustee. Nor does the record establish that plaintiff obtained a benefit in the bankruptcy proceeding by taking one position in that proceeding and then assuming a contrary position in this action simply because his interest changed. So the takeaway, judicial estoppel will be invoked only when a party has misled the court, for example, by hiding an asset in a bankruptcy proceeding and then attempting to collect on that asset. Next is Matter of Santman, on pages 16 and 17 of the May 2025 reversal report. Two issues were raised here when mother sought to compel a support magistrate to hold a hearing on father's alleged support order violation within the time limit set by the Uniform Rules for Family Court. First, the Second Department held that although the issue here was moot, the appeal should be heard as an exception to the mootness doctrine because the underlying issue will recur. And second, although the Uniform Family Court rules state certain time limits in mandatory terms, a writ of mandamus to compel was not available because courts have discretion to grant adjournments outside the time limits set by the rules. Therefore, the rules do not impose non-discretionary ministerial duties which are appropriately enforced by a writ of mandamus. So the takeaway, the time limits set for hearings and other matters codified in the Uniform Rules for Family Court, although written in mandatory terms, do not impose non-discretionary ministerial duties on a judicial officer, which can be enforced by a writ of mandamus to compel. Next is Jane Doe, on pages 17 and 18 of the May 2025 reversal report. This case explains the criteria for allowing a plaintiff to sue under a pseudonym. Plaintiff is suing her former employer, a charter school, contesting her termination, which apparently stemmed from a video. In granting plaintiff's request to proceed under the pseudonym Jane Doe, the court wrote, "This action concerns information of a highly sensitive, intimate, and personal nature, namely, a video depicting plaintiff masturbating. Plaintiff's affidavit establishes the serious psychological harm that disclosure of her role in this video caused her and would continue to cause her, as well as the potential impact on her career in education. That plaintiff was able to obtain a new job in education after her termination by defendants is of no moment, as she may still need to apply for other jobs in future, and it is not clear whether her current employer is aware of the circumstances of her termination. Defendants do not identify any source of prejudice to them from allowing plaintiff to proceed by a pseudonym, as they know who she is and therefore are not impeded in mounting a defense. The public interest in disclosure of plaintiff's identity is also minimal. Even if the charter school defendants were deemed public entities for these purposes, that fact would not be dispositive, especially because plaintiff is not requesting that court records be sealed or public access denied. Furthermore, the termination decision at issue here is not claimed to be the result of any government policy." So the takeaway, plaintiff should be allowed to sue using a pseudonym where the lawsuit will reveal sensitive, intimate, and personal information which would cause psychological and economic harm, and where defendants show no resulting prejudice and no public interest or governmental policy is involved. Next is Domen, D-O-M-E-N, page 28 of the May 2025 reversal report. This case simply illustrates that a demand for punitive damages cannot be stated as a separate cause of action. As the court put it, a separate cause of action for punitive damages is not legally cognizable. Next is Ezra Sons, Incorporated, pages 20 and 21 of the May 2025 report. Here, the Court of Appeals rejected the argument that certain choice of law provisions in the business corporation law displaced the internal affairs doctrine, which provides that the place of incorporation, England in this case, governs disputes about the rights of corporate shareholders and managers. Therefore, plaintiff, a New York corporation which holds shares in the English corporation, could not sue the officers and managers of a New York affiliate of the English corporation in New York. As the court explained it, the corporation at the center of this appeal is Barclays PLC, a bank holding company incorporated under the laws of England and Wales and headquartered in London. Plaintiff Ezra Sons Incorporated is a New York corporation and a beneficial owner of Barclays shares. Plaintiff commenced this action on behalf of Barclays against almost four dozen current and former Barclays directors and officers and a New York-based affiliate called Barclays Capital Incorporated. The complaint alleged that the individual defendants, aided and abetted by Barclays Capital, breached fiduciary duties owed to Barclays under English law, causing significant injuries to the company. The cited business corporation law provisions simply confer jurisdiction upon New York courts over derivative suits on behalf of out-of-state corporations, but do not require application of New York law in such suits. So to reiterate the holding of this case, the Court of Appeals rejected the argument that choice of law provisions in the business corporation law displaced the internal affairs doctrine, which provides that the place of incorporation, which was England here, governs disputes about the rights of corporate shareholders and managers. Therefore, the plaintiff, a New York corporation which holds shares in the English corporation, could not sue the officers and managers of a New York affiliate of the English corporation in New York. Next is Feeney, pages 21 and 22 of the May 2025 reversal report. This case simply illustrates that a stipulation entered in open court is a contract which can only be invalidated on a ground which would invalidate any enforceable contract, such as fraud, collusion, mistake, or accident. In this case, Supreme Court erroneously attempted to avoid the terms of the stipulation without holding a hearing to determine whether there was a valid ground to invalidate it. Next is the last case in the May 2025 reversal report. It's the Pujals case, P-U-J-A-L-S, pages 24 and 25. This case simply illustrates that a judge has the discretion to grant a late request for a change of venue. As the court explained, Supreme Court improvidently exercised its discretion in denying the defendant's motion pursuant to CPLR Section 510 to change the venue of the action from Kings County to Suffolk County. Venue is proper in the county in which one of the parties resided when the action was commenced, or the county in which a substantial part of the events or omissions giving rise to the claim occurred. Here there's no dispute that none of the parties resided in Kings County and that the accident did not occur in Kings County. By selecting an improper venue in the first instance, the plaintiff forfeited the right to choose venue. Further, the plaintiff failed to show that the county specified by the defendants was improper and did not cross-move to retain venue in Kings County or to transfer venue to a county other than that urged by the defendants. Although the defendant's motion was untimely, they promptly moved to change the venue of the action after confirming the true location of the accident. So the takeaway here, where there are strong substantive grounds for granting a motion to change venue, and there's a valid reason for the motion being late, the denying the motion is an abuse of discretion. At this point, I'm going to insert the third verification code for this January to June 2025 Civil Procedure Update CLE. The third verification code is DISMISS. Again, the third verification code is DISMISS. We are now in the June 2025 Civil Procedure Reversal Report. The next case is Bank of New York Mellon, pages 6 and 7. The Second Department noted that an argument raised for the first time in reply papers was not properly before the appellate court and should not be considered. As the court explained it, the plaintiff's contention is not properly before this court as it was raised for the first time in reply papers submitted to the Supreme Court, and there's no indication that the defendant was afforded an opportunity to submit a surreply or that this new argument responded to allegations the defendant raised for the first time in his opposition papers. So the takeaway, an appellate court will not consider an argument on appeal which was not addressed below by opposing counsel. Here, an argument was first raised in reply papers. Opposing counsel did not have the opportunity to respond to it, so the issue was not properly before the appellate court. Next is the Marinos case, pages 9 and 10 of the June 2025 report. This case illustrates when an appellate court will decide the appeal based on an argument first raised on appeal. Plaintiff was killed riding a rented moped. The question first raised on appeal was whether the arbitration clause in a rental contract encompassed the wrongful death action as well as the negligence action. In deciding to consider the argument that the arbitration clause does not apply to the wrongful death action, the court explained, the appeal presented a pure question of law that appears on the face of the record and could not have been avoided if raised at the proper juncture. So the takeaway here, if an issue presents a pure question of law which could not have been avoided by the lower court if it had been raised there, an appellate court can consider it. Here, no one raised the question whether the arbitration agreement encompassed both the negligence cause of action and the wrongful death cause of action. Because the language of the arbitration agreement is in the record and a wrongful death cause of action was alleged in the complaint, this is a pure question of law which could be determined for the first time by the appellate court. Next is Matter of Davis, pages 10 and 11 of the June 2025 Reversal Report. Here, the Fourth Department clarified the criteria for vacating an arbitrator's award as irrational. The arbitrator had found the petitioner was properly suspended without pay for failing to obtain a COVID vaccine. Supreme Court vacated the award as irrational. In reinstating the award, the Fourth Department explained, "An award is irrational if there is no proof whatever to justify the award. Where, however, an arbitrator offers even a barely colorable justification for the outcome reached, the arbitration award must be upheld. Here there is no dispute that respondent directed petitioner to fully receive the COVID-19 vaccine by a specified date, that it apprised her that her continued employment was contingent upon her compliance, and that petitioner refused to be vaccinated by the required date." So the takeaway, an arbitrator's award cannot be vacated as irrational unless there's no proof whatever to justify the award. Even a barely colorable justification for the outcome requires a court to uphold the award. Next is Wells Fargo Bank, pages 15 and 16 of the June 2025 reversal report. This case illustrates that the enforcement of time limits set by court rules is a matter of judicial discretion. Here in this foreclosure action, the failure to comply with the time limit imposed by a court rule was deemed a valid ground for dismissal of the case. Rule 8 of the Kings County Supreme Court Uniform Civil Term required the bank to file a motion for judgment of foreclosure within 1 year of the order of reference. The bank did not do so, and the Second Department held the action should have been dismissed. As the court put it, the failure to comply with Rule 8 is a sufficient ground upon which to dismiss a foreclosure action. So the takeaway, as discussed above, in the context of a family court rule, enforcement of time limits set by court rules is subject to the court's discretion. In that family court case, the failure to comply with the time limit set by the rule was excused as an exercise of judicial discretion. Here, the failure to dismiss the case because the time limit in the rule was not complied with was deemed an abuse of judicial discretion. Next is Tuminia on pages 16 and 17 of the June 2025 reversal report. This opinion answered a question of first impression, that being whether the 6-month extension for filing a new complaint after dismissal of a previous complaint can be used twice. The court answered yes. The extension can be taken advantage of twice. As the court explained it, the primary issue raised on this appeal is whether CPLR Section 205 Subdivision A permits a litigant to commence an otherwise untimely new action within 6 months of the dismissal of a prior action where that prior action was itself made timely only by a previous application of CPLR Section 205 Subdivision A. The plain language of CPLR Section 205 Subdivision A does allow a litigant to commence such an action. The federal court, the Second Circuit, had ruled that a second 6-month extension was not allowed under CPLR Section 205 Subdivision A, but the Second Department disagreed with the Second Circuit based upon the plain wording of the statute. Next is Wallace on page 21 of the June 2025 reversal report. Here, the trial judge exceeded the court's powers by dismissing the complaint in the absence of a motion by the defendants. The complaint was dismissed on the eve of trial based on an evidentiary issue. The court wrote, "By sua sponte dismissing the complaint before plaintiff presented any evidence, the court deprived plaintiff of an opportunity to oppose dismissal and deprived defendants of an opportunity to state the grounds that supported dismissal. We can find no legal authority that permits a court on its own motion to dismiss a complaint on the eve of trial without any request for such relief. Although the court determined that plaintiff cannot substantiate his claims, the court nevertheless erred in dismissing the complaint on that basis moments before trial was to commence without any request for such relief from defendants. So the takeaway, sua sponte actions by a judge are not favored. Here, the judge's dismissal of the complaint, apparently on the ground plaintiff did not have sufficient evidence to proceed to trial, deprived the defendants of the opportunity to state the grounds for dismissal and to deprive the plaintiff of the opportunity to oppose dismissal. It also deprived the appellate court of a record and a ruling on the underlying evidentiary issue. Next is Blattner on pages 22 and 23 of the June 2025 reversal report. This rear-end collision case highlights the criteria for a judgment notwithstanding the verdict pursuant to CPLR section 4404. The rear driver is presumed to have been negligent unless a non-negligent explanation for the accident is offered and proven. There was no non-negligent explanation in the record. The court explained, the court erred in denying the post-trial motion for judgment as a matter of law on the issue of defendant's negligence. A party is entitled to judgment notwithstanding the verdict where there is no valid line of reasoning and permissible inferences which could possibly lead rational persons to the conclusion reached by the jury on the basis of the evidence presented at trial. The rearmost driver in a chain reaction collision bears a presumption of responsibility, and a rear-end collision with a stopped or stopping vehicle creates a prima facie case of negligence and imposes a duty on the operator of the moving vehicle to come forward with an adequate non-negligent explanation for the accident. So the takeaway, if the trial evidence does not support the verdict as a matter of law, a post-trial motion for a judgment notwithstanding the verdict preserves that evidentiary issue for appeal. Next is Globalized Realty Group on page 25 of the June 2025 report. This case illustrates the rule that the failure to reject a late answer within 15 days waives the objection to late service and the default. In addition, because the plaintiff did not move for leave to enter a default judgment, the judge did not have the power to reject the answer sua sponte, as the court explained. Pursuant to CPLR 2101 subdivision F, the party on whom a paper is served shall be deemed to have waived objection to any defect in form unless, within 15 days after the receipt thereof, the party on whom the paper is served returns the paper to the party serving it with a statement of particular objections. Here, the plaintiff's undisputed failure to reject the answer within the 15-day statutory time frame constituted a waiver of the late service and the default. Moreover, the plaintiff did not move for leave to enter a default judgment against defendants. Therefore, Supreme Court should not have rejected the answer. So the takeaway, make a timely rejection of a late answer and move for a default judgment. Next is Salter on pages 27 and 28 of the June 2025 report. Here the issue is whether plaintiffs have sufficiently alleged connections between the individual defendants and New York such that they were entitled to jurisdictional discovery. The complaint alleged a mass shooting in Buffalo was facilitated by body armor worn by the shooter and made by the defendant RMA. Defendants Waldrop and Clark are a principal and an employee of RMA, respectively. The complaint alleged Waldrop and Clark knew the body armor was being sold to civilians in New York. The allegations were deemed sufficient to warrant discovery to determine whether New York has long-arm jurisdiction over the defendants. as the court explained it, as the parties seeking to assert personal jurisdiction, the plaintiffs bear the burden of proof on that issue. Nevertheless, as we have held, in order to defeat a motion to dismiss based upon lack of personal jurisdiction, a plaintiff need only demonstrate that facts may exist to exercise personal jurisdiction over the defendants. We agree with plaintiffs that they have set forth a sufficient start to show that their position is not frivolous. So the takeaway, in order to allow plaintiffs to conduct jurisdictional discovery to determine whether New York has long-arm jurisdiction over defendants, the plaintiffs need only demonstrate that facts supporting personal jurisdiction may exist and set forth a sufficient start to show their position is not frivolous. Next is Reyes on page 29 of the June 2025 report. This is another case dealing with the effect of a violation of a court rule. Here there was a Supreme Court part rule requiring a conference before a party may move to compel compliance with discovery demands. Plaintiff made a motion to strike defendant's answer or compel compliance with discovery demands without first seeking a conference, and the judge denied the motion based on the violation of the part rule. The First Department reversed, holding that the court cannot condition the making of a motion on prior judicial approval. So the takeaway apparently is that a court rule which requires a conference as a prerequisite to making a motion is unenforceable. Next is Matter of Crystal NN, pages 29 and 30 of the June 2025 report. This family court case explains the criteria for determining a motion to dismiss the petition made at the close of the petitioner's proof. Here, mother, the petitioner, sought a modification of custody. And as the court explained it, where family court is tasked with deciding a motion to dismiss at the close of petitioner's proof, the court must accept the petitioner's evidence as true and afford the petitioner every favorable inference that could reasonably be drawn from the evidence, including resolving all credibility questions in the petitioner's favor. Family court's commentary on witness credibility in resolving the motion suggests to this court that an incorrect legal standard was applied. When viewed in the proper light, we find that the proof was sufficient to withstand a motion to dismiss. Thus, without passing judgment upon the ultimate success of mother's claim, we reverse. So the takeaway, in determining a motion to dismiss a petition in family court which is made at the close of the petitioner's proof, the judge must afford the petitioner every favorable inference and resolve all credibility questions in the petitioner's favor. Next is Bank of America on pages 31 and 32 of the June 2025 report. This case illustrates the criteria for a non-party's intervention in ongoing litigation as a matter of right. Here, the non-party, called Beach 12, was entitled to intervene in a foreclosure action. Beach 12 had become the title owner of the property after plaintiff bank filed a notice of pendency. The court explained, upon a timely motion, a person is permitted to intervene as of right when the representation of that person's interest by the parties is or may be inadequate, and the person is or may be bound by the judgment, or when the action involves the disposition of property and that person may be affected adversely by the judgment, citing CPLR 1012 subdivision A, 2, and 3. In addition, CPLR 1013 provides that a court has discretion to permit a person to intervene when the person's claim or defense and the main action have a common question of law or fact. Whether intervention is sought as a matter of right under CPLR 1012A or as a matter of discretion under CPLR 1013 is of little practical significance, since intervention should be permitted where the intervener has a real and substantial interest in the outcome of the proceedings. Intervention may occur at any time, provided that it does not unduly delay the action or prejudice existing parties. Beach 12 was entitled to intervene because this action involves the disposition of title to real property, and Beach 12, which became the title owner of the premises after plaintiff's filing of a notice of pendency, would be bound and adversely affected by a judgment of foreclosure and sale. So the takeaway, in the absence of undue delay or prejudice to the parties, a non-party is entitled to intervene in an ongoing action at any time if the non-party has a real and substantial interest in the outcome of the proceedings. Next is Matter of Vincent, pages 32 and 33 of the June 2025 report. Here the mayor of New York City had refused to implement local laws passed by the city council, which increased eligibility for rental assistance. The mayor's refusal was based on the conclusion that the local laws were preempted by the state social services law. The first department, in a complex opinion, determined the local laws were not preempted by the state social services law, clearing the way for implementation of the local laws. So the takeaway here, consult this complex opinion for a careful analysis of preemption in the context of New York City local laws addressing homelessness and evictions versus the New York State social services law. At this point, I'm going to insert the fourth verification code for this January 2025 through June 2025 Civil Procedure Update CLE. The fourth verification code is preemption. Again, the fourth verification code is preemption. Next case is Hernandez on pages 34 to 36 in the June 2025 reversal report. Here the plaintiff in this negligence action against the city alleged she was injured when a bus driver stopped short. She filed a notice of claim but included the wrong accident date. Supreme Court denied her motion to amend the notice of claim. The second department reversed, finding that the wrong date was not used in bad faith and did not prejudice the city. As the court explained it, to enable authorities to investigate, collect evidence, and evaluate the merit of a claim, persons seeking to recover in tort against a municipality are required as a precondition to suit to serve a notice of claim. General Municipal Law Section 50-E, Subdivision 2, requires that the notice of claim set forth, among other things, the time when, the place where, and the manner in which the claim arose. In determining compliance with the requirements of General Municipal Law Section 50-E, courts should focus on the purpose served by a notice of claim. Whether based on the claimant's description, municipal authorities can locate the place, fix the time, and understand the nature of the accident. Pursuant to General Municipal Law 50-E, Subdivision 6, a court has discretion to grant leave to serve an amended notice of claim where the error in the original notice was made in good faith and where the other party has not been prejudiced thereby. Plaintiff's mistake was based on her reliance on a police report that incorrectly listed the accident date. So the takeaway, a motion to amend a notice of claim to fix a mistake, including the wrong date for the accident, should be granted if the mistake was made in good faith and the municipality was not prejudiced by the mistake. Next is Matter of Arvizu on pages 36 and 37 of the June 2025 report. This is another New York City bus accident notice of claim case. Here the petitioners moved to file a late notice of claim. The petitioners did not have an adequate excuse for failing to timely file the notice, but in reversing the denial of the motion, the Second Department focused on the city's timely knowledge of the facts. The police report, which had been sent to the city, indicated the bus driver acted wrongfully and named injured passengers. The absence of an adequate excuse was not determinative. So the takeaway here, the police report, which had been sent to the city, described the wrongful conduct by the bus driver and named the injured passengers. The police report effectively functioned as a timely notice of claim, fully informing the city of the facts indicating the potential culpability of the driver and the identities of the injured. The city's timely knowledge of the facts standing alone was deemed a sufficient ground for granting the motion for leave to file a late notice, notwithstanding the absence of an excuse for failing to timely file. Next is Matter of Wisnowski, pages 37 and 38 of the June 2025 report. This is another notice of claim case which illustrates the court's focus on the importance of whether the city had actual timely knowledge of the underlying facts. Here, the Fourth Department held the claimant was entitled to pre-action discovery to ascertain whether the city had timely knowledge of his accident as a prerequisite for his motion for leave to file a late notice of claim. The claimant alleged he told his employer about the accident, and his employer notified the city, the owner of the construction where he was injured. As the court explained, claimant allegedly sustained injuries while working as a laborer at a construction site owned by the City of Buffalo. In support of his application, claimant sought any incident reports concerning the accident and any correspondence concerning the accident. Claimant alleged that he told his employer about the incident 5 days after it occurred and believed that his employer notified the city at that time. We agree with claimant that Supreme Court abused its discretion in denying that part of his application seeking pre-action discovery, citing CPLR 3102 subdivision C. Claimant demonstrated that pre-suit discovery is needed in support of his application for leave to file a late notice of claim for the purpose of establishing when the city had actual knowledge of the facts. We remit the matter to Supreme Court to determine the extent of the pre-action discovery that's warranted. So the takeaway here, in the context of a motion for leave to serve a late notice of claim in a negligence case against the city, whether the city had timely actual knowledge of the accident is of central importance. Here, the injured person was entitled to pre-action discovery of correspondence, which may show when and how the city was informed of the accident, as a prelude to his motion for leave to file a late notice. Next is Aideyan, A-I-D-E-Y-A-N, pages 38 and 39 of the June 2025 report. This case explains who is an authorized agent of a school district for the purpose of validly accepting service of a summons and complaint. Here, the assistant superintendent was handed the papers. The Second Department ruled the assistant superintendent was an authorized agent and the service was good, as the court explained. An assistant superintendent directly carries out duties that typically would be carried out by the superintendent. These duties fit closely with the statutory definition of school officer as contemplated by Education Law Section 2, Subdivision 13. The assistant superintendent reports directly to the superintendent of schools and the Board of Education and is charged with administering functions that otherwise would be tasked to the Board of Education and or the superintendent of schools. So the takeaway, whether a school district employee is an authorized agent of the school district for the purpose of accepting service of a summons and complaint, depends on whether the person's duties fit closely with the definition of school officer in the education law. And we're turning to the last case in this January to June 2025 CLE, this civil procedure update CLE. It's Lambos on pages 42 and 43. The question raised in this case is whether the breach of fiduciary duty cause of action is time-barred, as claimed by the defendants. The statute of limitations for breach of fiduciary duty begins to run when there has been an open repudiation of the fiduciary obligations. The defendants never asserted that they openly repudiated their obligations, so the defendants didn't demonstrate the statute of limitations had even begun to run, let alone run out. So the takeaway, if a defendant in a breach of fiduciary duty action argues the statute of limitations has expired, the defendant has to demonstrate when it repudiated its fiduciary obligations, because it is open repudiation of the fiduciary duty that starts the statute. Here, the defendants didn't assert that they ever repudiated their fiduciary obligations, so they did not show that the statute of limitations had even started running. So that concludes this January through June 2025 civil procedure update CLE.